Sierra Civils, nuclear engineer in the air and missile defense sector of the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory. Welcome, Sierra.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start out with a little bit about your background. So I've read a bit about this, and something I find particularly interesting is that there was a moment or a series of moments during high school that made you take a 360 in terms of your career aspirations, at least as much as you can when you're 16 years old. Can you talk a little bit about what your career plans were when you were in high school and what subsequently set you on a path to becoming a nuclear engineer?
Sure. So when I was in high school, I was in culinary arts. I was really interested in being a pastry chef. And I took a chemistry course. I did really well in math and science, but it was always something that I was supposed to do, right? I'm supposed to make A's. I'm supposed to get good grades and things like that. So I did really well in math and science. I took a chemistry course and I did really well in that and I enjoyed it. And the teacher of that course knew. So he kind of suggested, hey, maybe you should take an AP class and, you know, see how well you do. And from there, he suggested, I know like you're interested in culinary arts, but have you ever thought about engineering? And I was like, no, I don't even know what that is. And so he was like, well, you should go look into it. Go look it up, do some research and come back and let me know what you think. So from there, that was my first, you know, introduction into engineering. And so I started looking into it and I was like, oh, you can make a career out of this thing. And, you know, he was really influencing and saying, you know, culinary is cool. And I think that's really fun, you know, that you can do that, but you also have this skill, right? You also have this natural talent when it comes to science. So maybe that's where you want to put your energy. So from there, he was kind of encouraging me to look into engineering schools, you know, figure out what institutions you want to apply to. And I would bring him different universities and he'd be like, oh no, you can get into a better school than that. And so I ended up bringing MIT to him and MIT, I never heard of it, had no idea what it was. And he was like, this is the kind of school that you should be applying to. And so ultimately I got into MIT and when I got there, you know, I was saying, oh, I'm gonna be a chemical engineer. And my host was kind of like, well, chemical engineers do plastics and polymers, and you seem like you're more interested on a smaller level. Maybe you want to look into nuclear engineering. And so that was kind of my introduction to nuclear engineering. And I'm like, I have no idea what that is. And so again, doing this thing of, okay, well, let me do some research and figure out, you know, what are the topics and aspects of nuclear engineering. So that's kind of how I got on that path.
So do you still enjoy culinary arts or did you take off in the engineering direction and never look back?
I still enjoy cooking. I just got a KitchenAid when I moved into my house. So I'm still baking, especially with COVID. Like you have a lot more time at home. So now I have a lot more time to experiment in the kitchen.
For sure. So I want to talk a bit about your school experience after you graduated from high school. And particularly some of the research you did throughout your graduate studies. So as I understand it, you did a lot of work, including a thesis on nuclear nonproliferation. Could you talk a bit about your thesis and also more broadly how your background in engineering strengthened your understanding of nuclear policy and nonproliferation?
Okay, so I have a couple ways I can respond to this. So first of all, let me talk about my thesis specifically. So the research that I did was trying to build a advanced radio xenon detector for treaty verification. The treaty we were specifically trying to verify was the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which bans nuclear testing anywhere in the world, any form. So underground, underwater, above ground, bans any type of testing. And so the way that I got involved in this research was at MIT, you know, as I was coming to the end of my journey and trying to figure out if I was going to go to grad school, I was, you know, like, oh, you know, maybe I'm interested in policy, right? Because I'm interested in nonproliferation. I'm interested in weapons. And, how can we limit the spread of weapons, which is what nonproliferation stands for. And so doing that, I ended up doing a summer internship at Monterey Institute, which is now Middlebury Institute, for the Center of Nonproliferation Studies. So when I did that policy internship, I started to understand as an engineer, okay, these are the sciences that are impacting the way that policy is written. So if you look at the history of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, in order for you to verify a treaty like that, you have to be able to say whether or not someone is conducting nuclear tests, right? And so that's where my engineering background comes in, because it says, okay, what quantities do we need to identify, or what signatures do we need to identify to say that a nuclear explosion has taken place? And so back to my graduate studies, we looked into radioxenon, because it's a gas that can be released even if you're doing underground explosions. And so that gas can travel all throughout the atmosphere, and with the treaty being set up, they establish a verification regime that puts detectors all over the world that are running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, always getting data, right? And so what the purpose of those systems is to say, hey, I've basically sniffed out a little bit of radioxenon. These are the isotopes that I measured, and give it to the analyst to say, okay, does this signature that you measured represent a nuclear explosion? Does it represent some leak from, say, a reactor like Fukushima, or, you know, some power plant like Fukushima? Because that Fukushima was really the first time on a big stage that technology was shown. So because of the amount of radiation and things like that, the signatures from Fukushima travel all the way to the West Coast, and they were measured from those radioxenon systems in Washington. So
that's fascinating. So you and your team for your thesis sort of developed this system. Was this the first time that this system was used, or was it, or did you?
Well, I should say what I did specifically is there's already systems in the field, and these systems have been around since the 90s. So my focus was, how can we make these systems better? Because the same way that technology is improving, radiation detectors are getting smaller, data acquisition is getting faster, people are also looking at better ways to contain, better ways to hide, you know, what they're doing. So how can we make our detectors that are in the field, how can we upgrade them basically and make them more sensitive? Are there different analysis techniques that we can use to better identify signatures? Does that make sense?
Got it. That's really interesting. And I think that's interesting, especially for us at the Atlantic Council, because we focus almost entirely on nuclear policy. So I don't think we really get into the weeds as much on the science aspect, which is obviously so important. So thank you for sharing that. So one other thing I'd like to ask you about is your current job. So, you know, I've spoken to a number of people with a variety of backgrounds in nuclear energy, but I don't think I've spoken to anyone at a place so shrouded in mystery as the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab. I know you're not able to share too much about what you do, but could you give a very brief, high-level overview of your
Okay. So there is a lot of history at APL, and I just want to say that APL does a variety of research, things in space, things in artificial intelligence, things in health. But specifically, I work, and I did a 360 from what I did for graduate school. I actually don't do any experimental work at APL. Everything I do is simulation based. And so I actually look at the radiation effects on materials and how radiation changes material properties, how that can influence other experiments or other technologies and things like that. And so that work is related to the national security space.
So moving on a little bit, you know, we've been having a lot of conversations, you know, within my office and also externally about the role of diversity in nuclear energy. And I know these types of conversations are happening more broadly in other STEM fields as well. So just a little bit on your history, I'll relay, and then if you could expand a bit. You're the first Black woman to graduate with a PhD in nuclear engineering from the University of Michigan. And throughout your education and your career now, you've also been involved in a variety of groups aimed at increasing minority representation in STEM. Could you talk first a little bit about your personal challenges and experiences, and also any moments of mentorship that shaped your personal activism or career, And also, what advice you would give young women or men from minority backgrounds who struggle to find mentors in STEM?
Okay. So personal challenges and experience. I think even back in high school, because of where I grew up, I was typically the only Black person in my class, or, you know, one of few females in my class. And so I think from a very young age, my parents kind of prepared me for this also. My parents both went to historically Black colleges and universities, so HBCUs. So they instilled in me very young that, you know, you look different, you know, people are going to have perceptions of you based on just the color of your skin. And I was taught that at, you know, a fairly young age. But I was also taught that it's okay, right? Like, you are you, like, and you're smart. And so what the advantage that you have is that no one can take that away from you, right? You'll always be able to let your work speak for itself. And so that's kind of how I went through a lot of my experiences, saying, okay, well, this person doubts me, or maybe they, you know, they have a different experience or perception, but let's just talk about the work. Let's focus on the work. And so that's how I kind of tend to get through a lot of those challenges. But I think having also these connections to NSBE, to Women in NERS, to the ambassador program, I think these strengthen your confidence when you are in these spaces where you're feeling like an imposter or you're feeling isolated. And so one, that's really the advice that I would give for women or men that are minorities, that are struggling to find mentors, is sometimes a mentor doesn't have to be someone that's older than you. It can just be someone that's maybe going in the same trajectory or the same path that you're on. So like in grad school, for me, some of my mentors were my friends, because I just needed people that I could vent to, that look like me, that understand, you know, what I'm going through. And then sometimes I need someone that doesn't look like me to be a mentor to help advocate, right? So you have to find mentors based on what you need or what you're lacking at the time.
Could you talk a little bit about some of the advocacy you've done? I know you're an if-then ambassador. Could you talk a little bit about that? And also some of the programs that you were involved in while you were in graduate school.
Okay. So let me talk about if-then first. So if-then is a national initiative. It was started by Lyda Hill. She and her team, they went through a rigorous process. We all had to apply, and they picked 125 women ambassadors. And these, including me, we have all different backgrounds. People are mechanical engineers, they're in cosmetics. And the idea is to show that STEM doesn't look one way. And it's kind of to empower young girls to see that STEM can be fun and that it's accessible. And so she's done a ton of things, giving us programming, giving us this national platform to tell our stories, all through social media, through different partnerships. So I'm actually partnering with Goldie Blocks. I've done Nepris things. I've done a variety, especially with COVID, you're able to do a lot of virtual events. I also at APL work with the STEM office. And so that's one of my favorite things about working at APL specifically, is that they have a built-in STEM office that I don't have to do the legwork. They are people trained in education. They have connections with the Boys and Girls Club of Baltimore. And so I can literally just come in and volunteer and not have to do the legwork like you would have to do in grad school, where I was a part of DAPSEP. And so that was a Saturday program for Detroit students, mostly of color, where we came in and we taught them about nuclear engineering, and we did experiments and you know, work with them. And we wanted to show them that, hey, there are people that look like them in these fields. And also with Women in NERS, the thing that I wanted to do by starting that was to create a safe space for women in this field of nuclear engineering, because it is skewed, you know, towards men, just to say, hey, let's come together and create a community where we can discuss positives and negatives and just have some camaraderie.
So I think, at least as I understand it, you know, there's two ways that you can go about bringing diversity into STEM fields and nuclear engineering or nuclear science. One is that the opportunities have to be there. And then the second is that those opportunities need to be retained. Like people of color or minority communities who go into these fields need to feel like they can advance. Right. So do you see that, you know, even as these educational opportunities become available, or there's more of a push for diversity in STEM education or nuclear engineering, do you see that these opportunities translate into career advancement, or is that still another hurdle that, you know, needs to
be? Let me ask you, because when I saw this question, I wasn't necessarily sure what you meant by career advancement.
So I think in conversations that I've had and in what others have told me about the field of nuclear science or nuclear engineering, and this may be different, you know, if you're working at a nuclear power plant or in certain communities or career paths, but there might be opportunities available for people of color or minority communities, but then, you know, you end up in a situation where you are the only person who looks a certain way or has certain experiences, and that deters you from continuing on at that job, or you feel like there just aren't as many mentorship opportunities or opportunities for career advancement to, you know, get to a, you know, you can start out, but I don't know, is like, do you feel there's support to get to a managerial level? So I'm just curious where you land on that.
For APL specifically, yes, I feel like there's a lot of support. One thing I will say is I think when you start to have these dialogues about diversity and about, you know, pushing even for women to have these STEM degrees, such as If Then is doing, I think the first thing that does is it creates exposure, right? And I think that's a lot of times what people are lacking when it comes to advancing. Because if you don't know that there's an opportunity, or you don't know that this thing is available, then how would you even get yourself in a position to advance, right? So I think when you start to have these dialogues and you start to have these opportunities, you get exposure. And even for me, that's one of the things that I tell people all the time is like, imagine if in high school, when I was a freshman, I came in and said I wanted to be a nuclear engineer, right? And imagine if someone had given me all the tools and the preparation of what that looks like, versus me deciding junior year of high school that, oh, now I'm going to do engineering, and now I have to catch up and take these classes, and then coming into MIT behind because I never intended to be an engineer, where people, their dream was to go to MIT, right? So it's, for me, it's always this idea about exposure. How can we prepare the next generation? How can we prepare the people coming behind us so that they can make these advancements? Because until someone decides to be the only one in the room and open the door for people behind them, it'll never happen. So I think, when you start to have these dialogues, it does open the opportunity for advancement.
So final question, what advice would you give to the nuclear engineering industry or other STEM related careers to make sure that those opportunities are available and publicized for whether it's women or people of color or other minority communities?
So I think you took the words right out of my mouth. I think the issue, especially, and I'll just talk about nuclear specifically. I think the issue with nuclear specifically is that it's not publicized in the most positive light. I think a lot of times people make an assumption about what it means to be a nuclear engineer. And until we change that narrative, and until we explain to people, nuclear engineering involves cancer research, it involves energy. Yes, it does involve non-proliferation, but everyone's not just making a bomb. Until we change that narrative, I think it's gonna be more difficult. So I think that's what we have to start focusing on. And that's kind of why I'm pushing for an If Then, is trying to show that, yes, I'm a nuclear engineer, but a nuclear engineer can do a variety of things.
That's really great. Thank you so much for that response and for your interview. It was awesome.
No problem. Thank you.